Hello and welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi, coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. On the show this week, we'll look at the power of social media in Africa. In the last couple of years, social media has become a popular platform for mobilization and one where people provide support to each other on issues of shared concern. And social media is credited for the Arab Spring that toppled governments in places like Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya. That was during the Jasmine Revolution a couple of years ago. And this explains why governments in Africa are always looking for ways to restrict its influence, including taxing social media usage or just plain blocking the internet in the country. And this has happened in places like Cameroon. It still continues up to now in many other countries. Uganda introduced last year a social media tax, much to the chagrin of many social media users in the country. And our story on the power of social media takes us to East Africa, in Burundi specifically, where the government arrested and detained school children for drawing or doodling on the photo of their president, Pierre Nkurunziza. Stay tuned, this Upfront on the Voice of America. Welcome back. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. So, the government of Burundi recently released three schoolgirls detained over accusations that they had scribbled or doodled in their textbooks over the photo of the country's president, Pierre Nkurunziza. After the arrest, the girls were transferred to a jail in Ngozi, about 50 kilometers from their school district. The news of this arrest, the arrest of these schoolgirls, caught the attention of the international community, many denouncing the rationale behind the arrest. And very soon, a social media campaign hashtagged Free Our Girls was trending on Twitter, global Twitter, and many other social media platforms like Facebook, but especially on Twitter. Thousands of people around the world were calling for the government of Burundi to release these girls. So when they were finally released, many started questioning, was the government of Burundi bowing to social media pressure, or did they just realize that this whole situation was just absurd and they needed to find a way out? Well, one of the activists responsible for bringing this issue to the attention of the global social media community is Keti Nivyabandi. She's a human rights activist from Burundi, but currently lives in exile in Canada. Keti joined me on the phone to talk to me about the human rights situation in her country. Keti, thank you very much for joining us. Can you give us a little context of why these girls were arrested in the first place? And is there a specific law that they broke or that prevents them from drawing in their textbooks?
Well, what we know is that the girls, so initially it was a group of seven school children, one boy and six girls, and they were arrested for doodling in their textbooks over the photographs of President Nkurunziza. So the seven children were arrested, and the four were released because they were under the age of incarceration, and they were under 15. And the three other remaining girls, 15, 16, and 17, were then charged with offense to the head of state. The full charge is a lengthy one, but it includes the fact that they are a threat to national security. And so they were then moved to a different jail, a different detention center, this time to a jail in Ngozi, which is at least 50 kilometers away from their hometown and their families, and that's the president's hometown.
So some people find it peculiar or strange that these kids were arrested for doodling in their textbooks. But like you said, I guess the question really is, why do academic textbooks in Burundi contain photos of the president? That sounds like some communist-era type of education system. Can you tell us what's going on here?
So I have not seen the textbook myself, but indeed there are several questions that need to be asked about around this matter. Number one, indeed, why do we have textbooks which feature the president in it, and what kind of texts are there which are accompanying these photos. So this is quite problematic. Secondly, for these kids to be arrested, it means that their teachers, the school directors, the headmaster, headmistress, and several other people were involved and reported these kids to the police. So this also tells you a lot about the state of the climate that's in the country and the fact that there's a great climate of fear and of, you know, almost spying and telling on each other to the authorities. And lastly, you have the fact that you have an entire, the national police coming into a school to arrest school children for doodles. I mean, it doesn't get any more absurd than this, but it tells you this is the state of Burundi today, and it reflects the dictatorship that really we are under and the gravity of the situation, but also how broken our justice system is and how human rights abuses are carried out by those who should be upholding the law.
So the girls were released. Do you think that the release, their release, had to do with the government bowing to international pressure, especially the social media campaign, or the government just realized the silliness of this whole situation?
It was absolutely the power of people power, and as particularly the power of social media. From the very beginning, we launched a hashtag, Free Our Girls. The hashtag has been trending globally. It's been picked up globally. Human Rights Watch, on the other hand, also wrote about this and launched a campaign asking people, where people all over the world doodled over the photographs of the head of state, and in an attempt to show the government that doodling is not a crime. So you had a global outcry over this, and absolutely, I'm very 100% sure that the government responded to the public oppression, the public humiliation that it was getting. I've just landed from Geneva, where I was at the Geneva Summit for Human Rights and Democracy, and I had asked also people to share the hashtag there, and there was a government representative in the room, and here you had people from all over the world using this and trending. I think it was very embarrassing for the government of Burundi to be seen in such a light, and this is the only reason why they released the girls.
So let me ask you this, aside from the social media campaign, what is, do you think, is the reason why the arrest of these girls captured the attention of the world, given that the other there are other numerous human rights abuses documented by organizations like Human Rights Watch and other international bodies like the UN, you know, regarding the poor human rights record of the government in Burundi? Why this issue, and what else should the world know about what is taking place in your country?
I think what captured the attention of the world is the absurdity of this act. You know, really to jail children for doodling in their textbooks, it doesn't get any more absurd, any more ridiculous than this, and it doesn't. And it's the best illustration of how low this government has fallen. So I think the world over, just people couldn't conceive. People who live in democracies or semi-democratic states just couldn't conceive that a whole government would be able to put children in jail over this. But what the world needs to understand, and particularly our African brothers and sisters, is that this is just, it is one out of thousands and thousands and thousands of human rights abuses that the Burundians are undergoing today. And yes, there's the doodling, but there are so many people losing their lives. There are arbitrary detentions happening almost on a daily basis. There are enforced disappearances that are occurring all the time. People are just being abducted and picked up in the streets, never to be seen again. I mean, the pattern of violence is so much bigger, so much larger. It's just that the government has gotten more sophisticated in how they carry out these acts. And so people are no longer killed, and you don't see corpses in the streets anymore, but people are abducted and they disappear and you don't see them again. And we have so many examples, and we have human rights organizations that even though they're not in the country, that are trying to uncover this. And a huge amount of reports and numbers of people who've disappeared this way. This is part of a larger pattern of human rights abuses. As you know, the UN Commission of Inquiry has determined that crimes against humanity are being committed in Burundi today by the security forces.
Mm. Do you think do you believe there's some sort of complacency in the international community regarding what is happening in Burundi?
Not only in the absolutely, because you know you don't hear. I think there are a lot of responsibilities both at the international community level, specifically at the African level, and particularly at the East African level, because you know our East African states have enabled this to continue by turning a blind eye on what's happening. They've given license for this to continue to occur. But then there's also the role of the media. I think the media also has stopped highlighting what's happening in Burundi today. Mm. And I know it's difficult to get information because media is not allowed to function freely in Burundi. But we need to keep the story going. Otherwise, the world forgets about it. Mm. And so this is exactly what many of us are trying to do. We need to keep the voices of the people who are affected heard globally, because we cannot go back. We cannot go back to dictatorships of the 80s, of the 70s. Right in 2018, 2019, it's unacceptable.
Right. Now, the arrest of these young students is not the first documented arrest taking place in Burundi. In fact, there was one, I believe, in 2016 or 2015. Around that time, other students were arrested for the same reason. What can you tell us about that case and how it ended?
Yes, in fact, it was in 2016. I believe it was July, August, a bit later on. It was in 2016, though, and it was a phenomenon that was spreading. It started in one school and it was spreading across the country. Students were doodling again in the textbooks over the president's photograph. It was an act of defiance and an act of resistance from students who are fed up, and there is no avenue for people to express their dissent and their dissatisfaction with the regime. There's no freedom of expression. So this is how these kids basically expressed themselves by doodling over the photographs. And a number of them were jailed, and other students did the same thing to support them. So it was a movement, but it was quickly crushed by the police, who arrested them and threw them in jail.
Okay. So the minister of human rights in Burundi, Mr. Martin Nivjabandi, says that the country is peaceful and that the government is protecting the rights of its citizens.
Today, the country is very peaceful. The country has security. The country doesn't have any security. It's not in crisis. The people must trust in its institutions of Burundi because we are very committed. We have several tools to protect and defend human rights in different ways. Burundi, we have to promote an ownership on these issues related to human rights.
What do you make of that? Are these institutions in Burundi functioning in ways that are protecting the citizens, the rights of the citizens?
They are not functioning at all. And because if they were functioning, Burundi would have no problem. The minister responsible for human rights would have no problem allowing the UN Commission of Inquiry into the country. They would not be shutting down the UN Office for Human Rights. They would not be pulling out of the ICC. They would not be running away from all international mechanisms of justice that exist. And so the attitude of the government actually betrays them. Mm. It shows them that they are indeed afraid of being investigated. And what the accounts that we receive from people, from human rights organizations that continue to work, even though their leaders are in exile, the networks within the country continue to work. The reports that we continue to receive and see directly are absolutely stunning. You know, these organizations produce reports on a monthly, on a monthly basis, on a quarterly basis, and the numbers are incredible. There's one campaign, the Don Leza campaign, which is solely dedicated to people who have disappeared. It has 117 fully documented cases to date, but hundreds more that families have brought forward, and they are still investigating. I mean, there's SOS Torture, which is an organization, again, that highlights and reports numbers of torture cases, disappearing cases, arbitrary arrests. All these organizations have reports that are appalling and show you that the abuses continue and continue to this day. And then you have the refugee crisis. You have people who are still living in Burundi to this day. And when they arrive, their testimonies are testimonies of abuse and of human rights violations, of rape, of extortion, of harassment. This continues to this day.
Aside from sharing the name Nivya Bandi with the minister, Martin Nivya Bandi, you don't share his optimism and confidence in the system?
Not only do I not share his optimism and confidence, I hold him responsible for these violations. I mean, if you were a person who's truly a person of integrity, you would resign. You would have to resign when you're in that position. But this is part of a propaganda of the regime, you know, to portray the country as a country currently at peace. But it is not at peace. It's an artificial peace. They have silenced all the voices inside the country. People are terrified. You know, people get abducted during the day, in the streets, and you know, bypassers are even afraid to scream or say anything because they're afraid that they're going to be next. This is the level of terror that's in the country. This is not peace at all. And so these ministers are in those positions to reinforce they are basically on a public relations campaign to claim that the country is at peace, because otherwise they would be fired. This is the reality. It's a fully authoritarian regime today. We have moved to a fully closed civic space and authoritarian regime and a full dictatorship.
Are you hopeful things are going to change once Nkurunziza leaves power? He says that he won't run in the next elections.
I think that we have to, we need to have a process, an electoral process that is free and fair. Right now, it's not even whether he will run or not. It's about making sure that the process is free and fair. And it is impossible as things stand today. The commission in charge of the elections itself is made up of two ministers of the current regime. How could this be an independent commission that's going to fully ensure that the elections are conducted freely? So it's really impossible to have free elections in this context. And until the media has been reallowed into the country, until all political parties are allowed to function, until civil society is fully reopened and able to function, and when we have a fully independent commission to plan and organize elections, then we cannot claim that we can have free and fair elections.
Katie, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much, Jackson.
That was Katie Nivya Bandi, a human rights activist from Burundi. She currently lives in exile in Canada.
We want a revolution. Young people revolution. Intelligent revolution. Must be African education. We want a revolution.
You're listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. We stay in East Africa, where our correspondent Joey Muthengi brings us the story of Muo Isaac. Muo is a young entrepreneur based in Nairobi. He's the founder and CEO of 10th Empire. And in his company, he leads a team of 20 young and talented coaches. Muo tells Joey that his goal is to help more people realize their full potential. Let's listen to their conversation.
Thank you here for Upfront. And this week I am sitting down with Moore Isaac, who's the founder and CEO of 10th Empire Limited, formerly known as Skate Empire here in Nairobi, Kenya. Now, 10th Empire teaches skills in skating, chess, gymnastics, taekwondo, as well as stocking equipment for all of these types of skills. So, Moore, young man, and yes. Here you are, CEO of 10th Empire. Exactly. Tell us how it all began for you, and when it began, the business.
Thank you very much, Joy, for inviting me to Upfront. As you said, I am the CEO and founder of 10th Empire. 10th Empire began as Skate Empire in 2014. Then I was still in campus pursuing my law degree. And then later I decided to plunge into business. It's not been easy starting a business and running one in Nairobi. Mm-hmm. But the challenges and things that are happening in terms of possibilities in the future make the journey worth it.
I want you to talk to me a little bit about the expansion of your business from Skate Empire to 10th Empire, where now you're teaching, like I said, chess, music, gymnastics, all these other things. What was the idea behind that, and at which point did you decide that I can expand my business now?
When I started the business, it was purely about skating. But down the line, we started listening to the customers more and hearing what probably will be different to them and how they will appreciate the business, and realize that there's really something else that is missing, a gap in the market that you can fill. And that's why we started last year. We started testing chess, teaching chess, and now we are teaching chess in one school this year. We started with one school. The idea behind this is to look at how the business can survive past 5 years, because most businesses in Kenya, when you look at statistics, most of them die within 2 years, and they die for various reasons. And if you have no way of changing your business plan along the way, when the waves hit you, you just close shop. So ideally, it was a way of making sure that our goal in the next probably 10 years is achieved, but also we have to change a bit. We have to pivot and make it more customer-facing in terms of what are the customers looking at right now. So we listen to our customers, and we introduce new sports. Now, we are working with schools mostly, especially primary schools and kindergartens, to help them operate their sports department. Mm-hmm. So they call us, we have a team of coaches, and we also have the equipment. So the school doesn't have to buy expensive equipment. Okay. Or hire full-time staff members. So we are reducing the cost for both the schools. Mm-hmm. And the parents. And the kids are happier when they have more sports to participate
in. More extracurricular activities.
Yes.
So when you say we, how many people do you currently employ?
Well, I usually say I am the 21st employee of 10th Empire. Uh-huh. I employ 20 young Kenyans. Actually, all of them are below the age of 28.
Wow.
And we have full-time coaches, mm-hmm. and we have part-time coaches. The idea in the future is to have more full-time staff so that we can impact more the young people, because these guys are really talented. Some of them have degrees, but they're really talented in sport, and we want to engage them in something that they love doing, and when they do that, they'll be more productive and probably contribute to the well-being of the Kenyan society.
Right. Yeah. As, you know, a young Kenyan, many of us were raised to believe that you go to school, you get your degree, and you look for a job. And if you don't get a job, you keep looking and you keep applying and you keep studying. Yes. Until something comes about. What has been the reaction of your friends and family in seeing you succeed in something that isn't, you know, a traditional way of going about sort of employment?
In the society that I come from, I actually come from the village. I came to the city because of university. And when my dad heard that I have stopped my interest in pursuing law, I think I was very, very, very shocked and bitter at the same time. And it took time and a lot of convincing from my elder sisters to make him believe that really the son that he had worked so hard for is
paid
now,
school fees for.
Yes, yes, toiled for to get him to where he wanted to be, will never become a lawyer, and he will never brag in the village probably that his son is a lawyer. And that is the expectation that we have growing up. We want to just fill the jobs in offices and to be well smartly dressed. But that, when you look at reality, it's such a contrast, because we have about 7 million people who are unemployed, according to Kenya National Bureau of Statistics. Mm-hmm. And most of them are young people. Mm-hmm. And the young people in Kenya are actually educated. So it is harder, it is getting harder actually to get a job. And for me, having gone to university, I can actually start something, and probably in the future, with a lot of hard work, it will create jobs for young people, and it will also impact people and encourage people in the future probably, mm-hmm. to also think about starting a business. Mm-hmm. It is doable, because many firms are coming from overseas and setting up offices in Kenya because the conditions are favorable, and we should be taking this opportunity as Africans, as Kenyans, to start businesses, to start small, mm-hmm. but with a vision of becoming a big enterprise.
Right.
Because it's possible. Yes.
Okay. So your final comments to young Africans listening, in terms of keys of starting a business, maintaining a business, growing it, mm-hmm. providing employment, like you've said, and just choosing the entrepreneurship route in general, what are some of the main keys you would give to people listening?
I think I'll give them two. The first one is, starting is very easy. Starting is very easy. Starting a business is easy. I can start a business tomorrow.
It can fail the next day.
Yes. But growing it is not easy. So I want them to imagine that they are planting a tree. All right? You select the tree. That is, you select the business idea. Then you water the tree over time. And after some time, they should have the mindset of long-term, not short-term benefit. After some time, the tree could give you fruits, could give you the shade, and that is what you get after a lot of planning, a lot of hours into the business. And I think that the secret is in just starting, but starting with a clear vision. It doesn't have to be 100 pages of your plan, but at least you have crystallized it into a small document that will guide you through the highs and lows of running a business. The second thing I'll tell them is, you need to be realistic with your expectations, because most of the time when you have a lot of people saying that they are entrepreneurs, but behind the scenes they are suffering because their businesses are draining them money, they're draining them hours, they're most likely actually going to pull the plug on that business. But if you have realistic expectations, you say, in fact, I will not break even within the next, I don't know, couple of months or couple of years, mm-hmm. and I will cut my expenses or I will sacrifice a few extra hours, because the start is usually the problem. The start,
yeah.
The 1 year after beginning, 2 years or 5 years probably. But then after that, there's something called exponential growth. After the first years of very small growths or even sometimes going backwards, mm-hmm. you get exponential growth. And that is where now you find these big entrepreneurs that you read about that just spent 4 hours in a week in the business have gotten to.
Yeah.
Yes, but you can't get to that putting 4 hours in a week when you just begin the business.
Yeah.
It is not possible.
Manage your expectations.
Exactly.
But also have a vision that's larger than the short term.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you so much. You've been speaking to Moore Isaac, who's the founder and CEO of 10th Empire Limited here in Nairobi, Kenya. He's a young man who's creating employment for others in terms of extracurricular activities, and also options for young people to keep themselves occupied and out of trouble. My name is Joy Mutengi on behalf of Upfront here for VOA.
And with that, we come to the end of the show, and we want to thank you for listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. You can connect with us on our social media platforms for more stories and conversations on a range of issues. Joey is at Joey_Mutengi, and I'm at Upfront Africa. And we'll catch you here same time next week. Remember, African elders say, those who cause others misfortune also teach them wisdom. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Good evening, Africa.